Your argument now in the case of United States against Mitov.
Court appointed counsel.
Mr. Clavel.
May it please this honorable court. I represent Mikhail Mitov in this matter. Your Honor, it is our appeal from a three-count indictment charging three episodes of extortion under the Hobbs Act. I'd like to begin, if I might, with the very first thing that happened on the first day of trial, the amendment to count one. Count one is quite different from count two and three. The extortionate demand was for money. The money was to come from Stephen Japp, a legatee of the deceased, his grandfather. And counts two and three do state that. But count one indicates that the victims are the law firm of Schwartz, Cooper, and Greenberger, whose attorneys, plural, which the government finds to be significant, were issued threats initially found by the grand jury on June 1st of 01, but amended by the court as surplusage under Criminal Rule 7D to be July 13th. July 13th, I might add, according to the evidence, was one of five conversations in 2001 prior to the FBI being involved in 2002 in which Mikhail Mitov demanded money. It is the only conversation, however, where both of the lawyers who testified were present at the same time. I don't believe that that should matter. I don't believe that an indictment can be amended on its face because the date of the offense is an essential aspect of it and must be proved. And so I disagree initially that it can be ever be a Scrivener's error. And the court, I believe, had a little bit of a problem in a prior case where the error was only one day. So here, where you actually have...
That was a statute of limitations problem, wasn't it?
No, I don't believe so, Judge. I don't believe it was. I believe it was a proof problem.
Supposing he had said on or about, would that be sufficient in the absence of a request for bill of particulars?
You know, Judge, sometimes when you have sales of drugs and things, you don't really know when things occur. This was not that situation. The government presented the grand jury with specific instances.
I understand that. I'm saying, supposing in the grand jury indictment it simply said on or about the 1st of June.
I think the court may give a day or two leeway either way, but if it happened the week before...
Why not within the statute of limitations? Why not 30 days? Why is the date so significant?
The date is significant because of the...
Be able to plan your defense. And the answer to that, of course, is to file a bill of particulars that they do an honor about.
You know, Judge, I believe that the real answer was that the government should have... provided under Rule 16, the notes, which would have had all these dates in them. But the defense did not have the dates. So the defense has an indictment that says a specific date.
I understand.
Why would you ask for a bill of particulars when you have a specific
date? Well, you would if you were producing an alibi defense. You'd have to know what day you're defending it.
That is true.
But there was no alibi defense in this case.
No, but the defendant knew that he had spoken with the lawyers on various occasions.
By the way, just as a throwaway line, there's nothing to do with the case. Is this Dick Schultz, the same guy who was first assistant U.S. attorney back under Tom Foran?
Yes, Judge.
Picked the wrong victim, didn't he?
Well, I would never call Mr. Schultz a victim, Judge, because I also...
Nor would he.
Yes. Your Honor, this is an interesting case, though, because, frankly, because of this lawsuit of undue influence, which never, I don't think the lawyers ever would have told their clients, you can win this lawsuit. It's not winnable. It is, as Richard Schultz said, viable, meaning because of our allegations, we can withstand the motion to dismiss, and maybe we'll settle it. Now, I only mentioned that, and I mentioned it in the beginning of my argument, because when you look at the circumstances in which the victims are alleged to have had a reasonable fear, you have to look at their expectations on the lawsuit. And while the lawyer, who was only the lawyers who are only charging count one, said he was important, he was essential, you never hear that from the victim, Stephen Japp, in count two and three.
But that's it's not for the victim to say. I mean, it seems to me the point the lawyer was making was that this is the kind of case that you see with estates like the late Mr. Japp's, and indeed, settlement does happen. There was, you know, the third wife. There are all these things going on that do happen. And that this extortion, which completely torpedoed the case, prevented the firm from going ahead with the usual sort of settlement. I mean, I didn't find any of that out of
there is
the realm
no
of
evidence.
Common sense.
Frankly, there is not one statement in the record by Stephen Japp that he ever expected to win. There
well,
is not one statement
not
of
the lawyer, though. His lawyer. You go to a lawyer and you say, Dad, you know, or Granddad, whoever he is, you know, gave all the money to the third wife, you know, where are we in this picture? And you go and you look at the caretakers and so forth. I'm not sure that I would place any weight on whether the client thought that, you know, the client's assessment of likelihood of success on the merits.
This could not have been more than a potential benefit.
Why isn't that enough? I mean, you
can
get a settlement.
It is not enough according to the case law.
You can get a settlement. That's real money. Not to mention the fact that the firm makes a reputational.
Well, Judge, that was not alleged in the indictment because the indictment says payment of monies from the law firm. That's count one. Not depletion of assets.
It says whose consent defendant attempted to induce by the wrongful use of actual and threatened fear of economic harm, actually, is what the indictment says.
It says in count one to obtain property in the form of payments from attorneys of Schwartz Cooper. That was never proved. And as a matter of fact, Dick Schultz said no.
No, defendant wanted the money. There were tapes of that. Wanted the $100,000 or the $200,000. And he tried to get their consent to pay that money by wrongful use of actual or threatened economic harm.
That is correct.
That's how the money comes in. It's on
the
his
The money
side.
Comes from Stephen Japp. And Mr. Schultz testified he always knew that.
Well, but it was going to go through the firm.
Yes,
with the conversations,
correct.
Which we've discussed in cases.
That is correct, Judge.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that the evidence was insufficient for the reasons I've stated. Thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ms. Murphy.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, good morning. My name is Madeline Murphy. I'm appearing on behalf of the United States, and I'm asking this court to affirm the jury's verdict on all three counts against Milko Mitov, as well as to uphold the trial court's sentence of Milko Mitov, since none of the errors that the defendant has discussed in his brief rose to either the level of clear error on the basis of the sufficiency issue or, in fact, any error on the basis of the sentencing issue. To turn to the argument concerning the amendment to count one, the gist of a claim of improper variance is that the defendant is not protected against double jeopardy because of the change in circumstances or date in the indictment. And the evidence here was unequivocal that there was only one circumstance under which the attempted extortion...
That comes during the trial. No, it's over here.
Yes, Judge.
I don't talk much, but once in a while... That evidence came out during the trial, huh?
The evidence came up shortly before the trial, Judge, when we finally did get notes from the victim law firm that ascertained the particular date of a conversation.
So it was immediately before the trial that you discovered?
It was immediately before the trial. However, all the discovery material that went
out...
What
was wrong with going back and getting a superseding indictment and putting the right date in? You didn't do an on or about. You just...
We did do an on or about, Judge.
The indictment call charges on or about?
The indictment does charge on or about.
Okay. We'll move from there. Was it impossible for you to get a suit? There's grand juries in session constantly here, aren't there?
Judge, we do have grand juries who sit 3 days a week. It is my recollection that we didn't get the notes from the law firm until, I believe, June 1st, and the trial was to begin on June 6th. Given that the state of the discovery material was that there was really no dispute as to what conversation was at issue. It was a conversation with two lawyers.
Oh, I understand that. It just seems to me that's one of those things you could have cleared up very simply, and you didn't.
I suppose I could have gone into the
grand jury. And that's why we're standing here yakking about the thing when it was an easy thing to correct.
Theoretically, it could have been an easy thing.
Not theoretically. Actually, it could have been corrected very easily. There's nothing theoretical about it.
Judge, I don't recall the specific timing of the dates here.
Without the timing, if you dismissed it and started all over again, you wouldn't have a problem with double jeopardy, and you'd start all over again. It may delay a little bit, but that was your fault, not his.
That is true, Judge. I could have done that. But under the circumstances where we have here, Judge, the evidence was unequivocal that there is no double jeopardy problem. Because all of the witnesses who tested at trial, Mr. Schultz, Mr. Belinsky, and the defendant, Mitov himself, testified to only one meeting among Mitov and the two attorneys at the law firm. So there is no circumstance under which Mitov could be retried, theoretically speaking, for some other extortionate demand made at some other meeting with the attorneys of the law firm. Now, turning then to the reasonable fear of economic aspect of the case. The gist of the defendant's argument is that the lawsuit was unwinnable, and therefore there was no reasonable fear on the part of the attorneys that they would not have the opportunity.
It amounts to a claim, as I understand it, that he wanted too much money.
Judge?
Since the suit was unwinnable, his testimony couldn't possibly have been worth $200,000. Had he asked for only $20,000, he might be guilty. But since he asked for much more money than the suit was worth, he couldn't be guilty. Am I understanding the claim correctly?
Boy, if I were you, I'd not accept that immediately.
Yes. That's right. The answer is yes.
I don't think I entirely understand your question, Judge.
What he's doing
had
is...
Had he made a smaller demand, the money would have been paid immediately?
He's rephrasing the defense and saying the defense was not that he did extorted it, but he extorted too much. And that if it had been $20,000, or $10,000, or $5,000, he'd have been guilty. But $200,000 is so silly that your case wasn't worth it.
It's my understanding.
Therefore, there's no economic threat. But that's
the defense is that under no circumstances, whether he demanded $5,000 or $5 million, would the case have been a winner, quote unquote. So the reasonable fear of economic harm was unfounded. Number one.
It might be worth $5,000 in settlement just to get rid of it. I mean, some cases are settled that have no value at all, except you're going to spend a lot of money defending, and why bother? Give them the money and shut up. But that's the part. Anyhow, he wasn't fighting with the understanding he was giving.
I know, Judge.
When he's nice to you, he'll be nice back.
I will make an effort to be nice back, Judge. As I was saying, the issue here isn't that the lawsuit was destined to win. It's that the parties here had the right to try. And the type of evidence that the defendant attempted to introduce in the trial court to prove his contention that the lawsuit was unwinnable didn't show that. For example, if the defendant had attempted to introduce evidence that showed, as a matter of law, all will contests in the state of Illinois fail because Illinois law does not recognize them, then he may have had an argument. But under the circumstances here, what the defendant attempted to do was to bring in a very narrow set of evidence in an effort to impeach the credibility of the lawyer who brought the state court case, and in an effort to get the jury for the extortion case to speculate as to the credibility findings that the jury in the state court extortion case would have made. So under those circumstances, we can't say that the lawsuit would have been doomed, and their proof, as they presented it, as a matter of fact, didn't come anywhere near showing that the lawsuit would have been doomed. And the gist of the extortion is not that they would have won the case, as I said, but that they were denied the opportunity to try. On the part of the law firm, they were denied the opportunity to engage in their business, which is to try cases. And on the part of Stephen Japp, he was denied the intangible benefit of the possibility of recovering in the lawsuit.
But you wouldn't have made that argument if upon looking at it, it had looked like a sanctionably frivolous lawsuit to you. I mean, you have to, it's got to overcome some hurdles.
That is true, Judge. If they had shown, for example, that no will instrument or attempted to show that no will interest instrument
or,
existed.
Or this one, you know, that the man had been seen, you know, jogging around the track, you know, every day up to the day of his death or something. You don't have to have quite as extreme a case as you're postulating to show that it would have been truly frivolous to have filed the suit, violation of Rule 11 if it were a federal court.
It is possible that they could have, under some circumstances, introduced some evidence showing that the will contest would have been a frivolous case. But that's not what they attempted to do here, Judge. They had a very narrow set of evidence that they wanted to introduce. They wanted to introduce interrogatories that were signed by Richard Schultz but had been attested to by Stephen Japp in an effort to show that Richard Schultz's statement of Mitov's initial interview changed over a period of time. Now, that evidence would not have shown that the lawsuit was patently frivolous or patently unwinnable. That evidence may not even have been admissible in the underlying state lawsuit. So under those circumstances, it would only have served to confuse the jury rather than show that the lawyer could not have had any reasonable fear of harm as a result of this lawsuit, because no reasonable attorney would have brought the lawsuit or would have thought that they had a viable case to litigate. So on these facts, the court's decision to keep out evidence, the narrow set of evidence that the defendant attempted to introduce, was in fact correct, because it did keep the jury from having to hear a little sideshow, as it were, concerning the merits of this case. There was no effort to show that the case was patently frivolous. The only effort that was made was this very narrow credibility issue. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I believe the government will stand on its brief and ask that you affirm the jury's verdict and the district court sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Clavelli?
Your Honor, I have nothing further to add to the court.
Okay. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.